Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
I would like to begin by acknowledging the country from which I speak today, the land and waters of the Wadawurrung people of the Kulin Nations. I pay my respects to elders past and present, and extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening in. I recognise the continuing and essential role that First Nations play in caring for a country, and I would like to admit that in this conversation today, there may be limitations of insight in terms of talking about nature as a non-Indigenous person. Hi, my name is Fatima Meesham. I am a writer and conservationist. In this episode, we will be discussing what it means to be attentive to nature, the impacts of colonization on the natural world, and whether we can undo that legacy. With me are Harry Sadler and Vicky Shukurugu. Harry is a Melbourne-based writer interested in the interactions between people, animals, and the environment. His book, The Eastern Curlew, The Extraordinary Life of a Migratory Bird, was shortlisted for the Queensland Literary Awards in 2019. His new book, Questions Raised by Quolls, Fatherhood and Conservation in an Uncertain World, was published in 2021. Welcome, Harry.
Thanks, Fatima. Thanks for having me. I'm in Melbourne, which is Wurundjeri country, and I'm originally from Canberra, which is Ngunnawal country. Both have had a big formative impact on my life so far.
Excellent. Our other guest, Vicky, is an artist, writer and researcher who endeavours to deepen our understanding and care of our precious world and each other. In consultation with diverse Indigenous communities, Vicky recently co-authored and produced photographs for Loving Country, A Guide to Sacred Australia. Hello, Vicky.
Hello, and thank you. I'm also on Wurundjeri country, and I'd like to acknowledge all the people around this nation who have long cared for the land, waterways and creatures.
Great to have you both. We'll actually start with you, Vicky. In your introduction to Loving Country, which you co-authored with Bruce Pascoe, there's this beautiful passage about how countless generations of Indigenous families carefully watched everything that went on in nature, not just for survival, but because they had, quote, curious and inventive minds. If I can read out this line that you wrote, their loving observations shape them as individuals and societies, as is reflected in dances and songs, complex stories, and the vitality of the country itself. What did you mean by this? What happens when we start paying attention to the natural world?
I think all sorts of animation occurs. So we are animals, and the more we look at ourselves in that way, the more we understand that we are part of this system. We are not separate to it. We are not better than it. We are not distinct from it, but we are part of it. And that means that we can have relationships of all different kinds, which just brings so much colour, vibrancy, all sorts of extraordinary complexity and connection that we can nurture. And as a community of human beings, the way we connect with other living organisms, whatever they may be, brings what we call culture. And culture can be nurtured by the earth, by all those other animals. And I guess, you know, when people have been living in a place for such a long time, 60, 70, 80,000 years, they become very intimately connected to a particular place. There is a deep understanding. There is a rich connection, emotional, mindful, spiritual body, which is all interrelated. And so there's a merging, there's a crossover, there's a really colourful way of understanding a place.
That's beautiful. I just wanted to make sure that we integrate that, because sometimes when we talk about Indigenous ways of seeing and knowing, we kind of sort of end up othering it in a really strange way when it's actually a really human story.
That's
so
right.
I just want to bring that down to a personal level for you. Like, have you had an encounter that might have been transformative for you or that opened up new ways of seeing and feeling?
Yeah, I think what you say is really important, because the extraordinarily wonderful thing about this is that these are human qualities. It's not who you are or where you come from or what's in your blood. It's just a human thing. we are all connected. We all have the power to do these things of observing, attending, relating. And I remember from my very earliest memories as a child, sitting in the sand and observing these microscopically small fragments of all sorts of things, shells, little tiny bits that I think were must have been iron because they were magnetic, I discovered. And, you know, just the sense of awe and humility that comes with that understanding that I'm no mightier, I'm no greater, I am part of this. We have all sprouted from the same place. You know, what we choose to nurture then informs us as human beings and our outlook, and then how we can choose. We can make choices of how we relate. We can choose to be these ways. We can choose to nurture the earth and all the other animals. We can choose to have a terrific relationship with our dog, or we can choose to abandon it and leave it in the back room. And these, you know, the whole earth is no different to that. I've had so many incredible connections with animals that people would call wild animals, so animals that I come across that haven't had much human connection, that really it tells me that there is reciprocity, there is understanding, there is curiosity. So, for example, the kangaroos here, they know me and they know my dog. They don't get frightened when we walk past. We talk to them. We say, hello, how are you going today? And they don't hop away. They just watch. And I can see that in the generations, there's a little Joey in the pouch and it's also learning. But if there are others around, they'll often hop away. And the same with echidnas, with white-winged choughs, with dingoes, it's happened, you know, with so many different things. Yeah, I think what you say is really important, that we keep this in the, it's like a solid foundation for every human.
Let me turn to you now, Harry. I wonder if any of what Vicky said resonates with you. Like, I know you've had some pretty transformative encounters as well, particularly one encounter that prompted decades later the writing of your latest book.
Yeah, that's right. So the only two occasions on which I've seen quolls in the wild were both in Tasmania, which is unsurprising because for the eastern and spotted-tailed quolls, Tasmania is their stronghold. Reflecting on what Vicky said, I think also a lot of the time we can choose how we interpret or how we respond to an animal encounter. And the reason I'm bringing that up now is because on these two occasions were on two separate trips to Tasmania where I saw quolls. On one occasion, it was eastern quolls in the Walls of Jerusalem National Park, and on another occasion, it was a spotted-tailed quoll on the South Coast Track. On both occasions, the quolls were coming into my campsite and stealing or attempting to steal food from my campsite. which, you know, is a pretty common occurrence, really, wherever there's camping and wild animals. And on the surface of that's obviously, you know, a really annoying thing to happen, especially when you're hiking on a week-long hike. You have, you know, sort of very carefully, you have, you know, you take into account what you can carry and how much food you'll need and all that kind of thing. And when a spotted-tailed quoll comes out of the tea tree and makes off with an entire fruitcake, it's a bit frustrating. But you can choose to, in the moment, and then certainly on reflection down the years, to A, see the humour in it, and also, but also B, see the tremendous privilege in it of having that close encounter with an endangered wild animal, or any kind of wild animal, not necessarily an endangered one, but something that, you know, very few people will see, regardless of the circumstances. You know, if losing a cake is the sacrifice you have to pay for that, then I think it's a pretty good trade-off, really, to be honest. And on I guess a more primal level, it also, you know, just reinforces again what Vicky was saying, that we are animals, and there's really, we have much more in common with other animals than we do that sets us apart. Now we have this sort of obfuscating layer of language, which is a fundamental part of who we are as humans, but it also tends to blind us to the fact that so much of our behaviour and so much of the way we experience and understand the world is, you know, in a sort of non-linguistic way, including enjoying eating cake.
Can I just dig down slightly deeper, drawing from both your experiences? Because I'm often struck about how paying attention to animals and plants often repositions or reframes many things that we think we understand, like time and work and even purpose. Like, does that prompt anything from either of you about how this attentiveness repositions or reframes certainly the way sometimes we are led to think you know, in terms of how we're meant to work or what time means or what time is for, what our energies are for. What do either of you reckon? Who wants to go first?
I think for me, what this makes me think of is something that I've become increasingly attentive to and aware of in the last few years, which is the seasonality of where I live, in Melbourne in particular. And this all plays into a lot of other thoughts I've had about no colonialism and the effects of colonisation on not just the Australian continent, but also the way we understand the Australian continent. I've been learning and taking an increasing interest in plants, in the native plants, over the last few years, and learning to identify the species that are around. And I'm still very much a beginner in that regard. But the more you learn, the more you see, and the more it changes what you see. And I've started noticing all the plants that flower outside of what we've been taught to think of as the typical flowering time of year, which is, you know, springtime, which, you know, in Southern Australia we call September, October, November. And the most probably best known example is wattle season, which everyone gets very excited about. And in years like this year was phenomenal. And that starts in July. Also, corias start flowering in July. Hop goodenias are flowering pretty much all year round. All these other plants that don't conform to what we think of as, you know, the time of plenty and the time when everything starts flowering and blooming, which is springtime. And thinking about that, I've kind of realised and come more and more to appreciate the fact that this spring, summer, autumn, winter, four season thing is just like a sort of it's a foreign idea that's been superimposed on top of a landscape in Australia where it doesn't really fit. And of course, Indigenous communities, Indigenous societies had their own seasons and their own calendar of seasons and understanding of things. I think in Melbourne, there were half a dozen seasons in the Wurundjeri calendar, I think. So, yeah, sorry, that was a very long, rambling answer. But yeah.
Well, let me use that as a platform to jump or throw or whatever the metaphor is to Vicky. Because, like, you worked quite extensively with Indigenous communities in various places. Using that sense of time, what's your understanding in terms of, you know, Indigenous sense of time, particularly in terms of food production? Because I do want to draw out the contrast between the colonial capitalist mindset and sort of Indigenous modes of care. So if you could just briefly just give us a sense of how Indigenous peoples sense time and how that has shaped systems of food production.
I think if we just frame it back to the original sort of foundation of, if we consider ourselves as humans and therefore accessible, capable of all sorts of things, what people will call Indigenous ways is very much just about paying attention to what is naturally, in, you know, however you want to define that, occurring. And it's not about forcing the land to do certain things, to do things in agriculture, for example, that they describe as enhancing soils or, you know, crop yields or, you know, adding fertilizers or creating systems that take far more than they give. And so I think if we look at how those, if we acknowledge that we're part of this system and the whole notion of enhancing our capacities to maintain a vigorous environment, you know, that all the old people that I speak to are very much about how do we look after this place, because we're not separate from it. And the sensing of what's happening in a season, whether it's the flowers that are blooming will indicate certain eggs might be available for collection, or, you know, there's all these relationships that have been observed over long periods of time and respected. And I think that's one of the key things. It's that saying we can notice all sorts of things about our world. And it's not about not seeing how we can also utilize these things. It's about saying, how can we respect these things while also benefiting? And I think, you know, Indigenous people have shaped the land. They have made changes. Animals have shifted in populations. Vegetation has changed as a result of different systems. But it's about also maintaining biodiversity for all sorts of reasons. And if we looked at agriculture today and said, how can we achieve these things? Is it possible to feed 25 million people while maintaining biodiversity, reinvigorating biodiversity, we would need to shift our minds into understanding the seasons. And each place is so particular. You know, the stories across this country are so diverse because the country is diverse. The Indigenous cultures are so diverse because the country is diverse. And if we were to look at the nuance that is present and find ways to nurture it and, I guess, capitalize on it, if we're going to look at the systems that we have and we really factor in the true costs of things, the environmental costs, the social costs, the all kinds of different costs. And I think that's part of the ways of thinking in the Indigenous communities is that those costs are framed differently and the values are honoured differently. And so, you know, while walking with a lot of the old people, there's this sense that there is an understanding of their impact of the connection and of what is nurtured through different actions, whether it's, you know, through the use of fire, whether it's through ensuring that no hard-hoofed animals enter spaces, whether it's through protection of waterways. You know, the way that we use water is extraordinary. It's like it's an infinite resource that is only there for our purposes. And so, you know, we need to really shift our perspective, I think. And it's a really exciting proposition. You know, I think about the children that I work with in schools quite often and how very quickly their mindset opens up, becomes incredibly sensitive if they just pay attention to a blade of grass even. You know, these things are intimately human. So I think there's a lot of exciting possibilities for Australia and how fortunate we are to be in this country with such a wealth of knowledge to be respected.
Vicky, I just wanted to expand on what you said about the diversity of cultures and just the diversity in Australia. Because I think one of the big obfuscations that we have as a result of the colonisation of Australia and is that in this particular moment in time in history, geopolitically, Australia is regarded as one country, whereas prior to colonisation, of course, it was hundreds of different countries. And we see that kind of play out also in the way we learn about nature. So we learn about how, you know, Australia has more endemic species than any other country. And it's like, well, it's, of course it does. It's an entire continent. You know, you're comparing the continent of Australia to, you know, the number of endemic species in South Korea or Kenya or something, whereas, you know, it's an error of scale. You know, so when we think of Australia as a monolith, it even just that very fundamental, simple thing just immediately obliterates all of the complexity and subtlety in the country, which inevitably has effects on how we think about the landscape and the environment in Australia.
So I'll turn back to Vicky, and then you can add your own thoughts as well, Harry, just in terms of the impacts of this incompatibility, because Australia is the record holder for extinctions of mammals, and it's not gotten better since it was identified. We were losing ecological communities to clearing and urban development and extractive industries. So can you paint a picture for me now about what the mechanics of colonization, I suppose, and the spirit in which it sort of is conducted versus what the land actually requires of us? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. It's a very big question. And there's a lot in it. But I think, you know, one of the key things, if we continue along our capitalist system, which is extremely difficult to change an entire economic global system. If we work within that and we say, right, we need to shift what we value, we need to shift the costs of things, how we actually cost every product. If we were to say, you know, this telephone, this mobile phone, the true cost of this thing is extraction of all kinds of different metals from all kinds of different places, all kinds of elements, things that I have no idea about in their fullest complexity, the components, the transport, the emissions, everything that has gone into a telephone, the cost of that would be so much more, it would represent so much more to people that our consumption would shift inevitably. And people would argue, you know, it's not possible to live lives like this, but I think we need to start factoring in these, the true costs of things. And in our everyday life, you know, we can all make changes to be kinder to the earth. And I think if we think about, I guess when we talk about a colonial mindset, maybe it is one that takes over, that imposes certain things. It is an imposition. It is not a kindness. It is not coming with respect on the whole. It isn't honoring what is present. And so if we start to honor what we have in this very subtle and very complex land, inevitably our minds will start developing new ways. Inevitably. That's why Indigenous cultures, the songs they have, the stories they carry, are of that mindset. They are reflective of that complexity and of the creatures and of the plants, because that's what is nurtured naturally. It's what's innately human in this particular country, in this particular land. You know, each, you know, moving from here to 50 kilometers away is different again. Another 50 kilometers, we have another dynamic change. Why? How come we're not factoring all those things in? How come we're living lives as though it's just a rubber stamp, one place the same as the other, able to yield wheat, able to yield sheep, able to yield, you know, all these things consistently? It seems to lack so much subtlety.
Well, I suppose I wanted to draw out the contrast, because I guess we don't want to go through another litany again of how of the legacy of colonization, because it's apparent. And I suppose I wanted to flip it in terms of, well, if that's the impact of colonization, how do we then decolonize? And I think you're right, Vicky, in terms of modes of restraint. And that's why I raised the idea of time as well, because it takes patience to let nature for fruit to form takes time, and you need to let nature have its own rhythms. But it's also a kind of decentering, moving away from the primacy of convenience on which, you know, capitalist systems are built. Is that, would you agree, Harry, just in terms of, I guess we want to start, I guess, thinking now about, well, this is what it is. It's what we've got. So we've looked at how colonization has interfered with the way nature actually works. What are your thoughts about, you know, what is required to address major ecological crises? Because, like, I remember seeing one of the recent UN climate reports said that it's not just technical solutions that are required. We also need a cultural overhaul.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd absolutely agree with that. First and foremost, and particularly in colonized countries like Australia, we need to get the Indigenous people involved really, really at all levels, I think. I'm not Indigenous. I don't have a lot of experience with Indigenous cultures, so there's a limit to how much I want to talk about them. But just on a purely common sense level, it seems apparent to me that the people who've been living on this continent for tens of thousands of years should have much more of a voice in how we do everything on this continent than people who've only been here for a couple of hundred years. I mean, that seems self-evident to me. Amplifying and boosting Indigenous voices, which, you know, then of course also require rethinking how we, as non-Indigenous people, as a sort of collective, think of Indigenous people, because, you know, we've been conditioned by 200 years of colonial thought and colonial education to shun Indigenous people and to think of them as lesser than, which is obviously a huge problem that people with much more experience and knowledge and wisdom about these things than me dedicate their lives to try to solve. And yeah, fundamentally, in Australia, as in probably most colonized countries, we need a reckoning, and we need to be honest and intellectually honest as well with the reality of what colonization has done, and, you know, come to terms with that. At the moment, it feels like we can't even talk about it, because, you know, as soon as you talk about it, there's going to be some other voice that's yelling you down for even acknowledging the damage that colonization has done in Australia. Sorry, I feel like you asked me a question looking for optimism. I gave you a fairly bleak answer.
I keep chucking like really big questions at you both to see what would happen. But I guess something a bit more concrete, just quickly. So it's sort of like second last question, because it can seem pretty grim. Harry, can you just give a quick rundown of a few examples that would make the case for optimism? People are actually already addressing that legacy.
Obviously, my current book looks specifically at a lot of work that people are doing in conservation to bring animals back to places where they have gone locally extinct. And yeah, there are a lot of people doing a lot of extraordinary work with not nearly enough money to gain incredible results to bring quolls and other animals back to places where they've gone. I think, Fatima, you could also talk about this a lot, I know, because you've done a lot of work, and I don't think you should hide your light under a bushel in that regard. So
it's just basically raking and picking up food. But anyway, keep going.
Oh, every bit of it is important. So one of the reasons I wrote my book is because I wanted to highlight the work that people are doing to try and make things better. And there is an incredible amount of work being done to make things better. There's been a lot of success. There's been some failure, inevitably, because conservation is not a linear path. It's crooked, with mistakes made. One example that I like to think of is a reserve called Mulligan's Flat in the north of the ACT. And they've reintroduced various animals there, including bushstone curlews and eastern quolls, into this huge fenced area of remnant yellow box grassy woodland. And it's surrounded by suburbs, the northern suburbs of Canberra. And every now and then, one of the animals will get over the fence and turn up in someone's driveway or in someone's front garden. And Mulligan's Flat use that as a kind of education opportunity. The outside the fence is not nearly as safe as inside the fence, because inside the fence there are no foxes or cats. Outside the fence there are foxes. The suburbs immediately surrounding the reserve are cat containment suburbs, so there's theoretical, hopefully, no outside cats. But yeah, the fact that these animals keep on going over the fence and turning up in other places, and then the community learns about these animals that are in their midst and would once have been in their midst, and come to feel then a sense of pride and ownership in those animals. And in fact, they've got this amazing reserve nearby. Yeah, I think that's a really nice story of very grassroots, local level kind of success.
Thanks for that. Final question for you both. We started with sort of just tapping into that sense of joy and wonder and awe and thinking about what that does to us and why it's really, really important to recover that in order to undo some of the, legacies from colonization, and just how, the current capitalist-based system works as well. And I think Harry's just touched on some of the ways that people are making a difference. So the question to you both, in terms of moving forward, tapping into our better nature, Indigenous peoples will always say that you belong to the land. We don't own the land. You belong to the land. What are your thoughts on what are your concepts of belonging as other than a set of privileges, and how that will actually bring us forward in terms of learning from modes of care that have been so successful on this continent for thousands of years?
I can speak from my personal experience. I wasn't born in this country. I was born in Cyprus, which is a small island. It's a, very different kind of culture in some ways to the Indigenous cultures here, but in all sorts of ways, incredibly connected, because there's a strong sense of family, there's a strong sense of what it means to care, there's a really strong sense of honouring all sorts of things that are also important in many of the Indigenous families that I know. And having come here as a 10-year-old, I know that the greatest teacher that I have had is the earth and all the creatures. And I know I belong to that place, this place, because I'm completely motivated by it. I am completely entranced by it. I live to honour it. And any decision that I make, any action that I take, is in order to nurture it, protect it, and endeavour to enable others to do the same in whatever capacities that we all have. And so my sense of belonging and my sense of who I am is very much a human being with love for this earth, and the earth that I know most intimately is this country here. And I can understand its sounds, I can understand its rhythms, I can look at a plant and not know it, but I can have a sense of whether it's actually an indigenous plant or not just by the feeling that I get from it. I can have connections with the creatures because it is my choosing to honour those. That is my sense of belonging, and it gives me strength and power and, you know, courage every day. It gives me energy. It gives me joy and fulfillment, and that to me is my foundational belonging. And so in the work that I do with kids, for example, a lot of them, there's a lot of argument, there's a lot of tension, there's disquiet, there's a lack of attention. And as soon as we begin to look closely at anything that is not inside a building, as soon as we start looking at ants and soil and seaweed or grass or whatever it might be, there is a difference, there is a shift in their sense of themselves and therefore how they relate to others. And that is belonging, I think.
What about you, Harry?
Yeah, so for me, I guess belonging comes from, first of all, from learning about and then observing and noticing the natural world around you. I spoke earlier in our conversation about how I'd been learning to identify plants. That started with learning to identify eucalypts. I thought, well, I'm in Australia, I should learn how to identify eucalypts at long last. And it only takes learning one or two different species to completely transform how you look at the world. Prior to starting to learn about that, and I'm still very much a beginner, whenever I'd travelled from Melbourne, where I live now, back home to Canberra, where my family all is, and sort of see the bush in the two places, a sort of fairly undifferentiated mass of southeastern Australia, even though, you know, bush had been in the bush, is sort of deeply ingrained in how I think of myself. After I started learning about eucalypts, the first time I went back to Canberra, I saw it in a completely different way. I suddenly saw, oh, all these eucalypts here, they're all red boxes, whereas I almost never see any red boxes anywhere where I am in a Melbourne. I have to go no further out to Eltham or wherever to start seeing them. That made me start thinking about where I'd grown up and where I'd come from and where I'd moved to in a different way, and then start seeing, helping me see the sort of the micro habitats of, you know, of where I am, you know, this very small part of Australia where I am, especially in the last year and a half in lockdown, who I've been confined to, sometimes only 5 kilometres. All of that, I think, builds up slowly, sort of accumulatively, a sense of connection to the country that you're on, and a sense of belonging and a sense of feeling. Learning about these things has made me feel for the first time really a little bit like I'm a Melburnian, and I've been here since 2004, but I've always and still feel like a Canberran. But I've also started to, as I've grown to appreciate and learn more about the natural world in Melbourne, started to feel a little bit more like a Melburnian in a way that no end of cafes or bars or anything like that ever could. Really. So, yeah, I think for me it just starts with learning, which is an ongoing and never-ending process, which could be daunting, but for me I think it's really exciting.
Thanks so much, Vicky Shikoroglu and Harry Sadler, for talking with us. I just want to finish with a line that I picked up from Vicky's book, something that the old people, elders, have told you in your travels. If you are on this country, you are of this country. And because you are here, you have a responsibility. Thanks so much for listening. I want to remind listeners that you can purchase Vicky's and Harry's books from our partner Bookshop Readings. Thanks so much for tuning in and for supporting Melbourne Writers Festival.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.